Welcome in to the Pick Six Podcast. John Niatawa, Sam McEwen sitting right beside me. Glad to have you in studio, Sam.
Hey, how's it going?
It's been a busy couple weeks.
Yes, it has. For everybody involved.
Yeah, Connie Yori resigns as women's basketball coach in Nebraska. We'll talk about that.
Yes, she did.
We might touch on the NCAA tourney, maybe a little baseball.
Oh, Husker baseball?
Maybe.
Yeah,
maybe some MLB predictions as well.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Well, at practice on Tuesday, Mark Banker mentioned that there's an injury to Chris Jones, so it's another member of Nebraska's secondary going down, and
right.
It's already a depleted unit. He mentioned, Coach Banker did, that 2 to 3 of the incoming freshmen may have roles, significant roles,
right.
Similar to Aaron Williams or maybe even Antonio Reed at the end of the year.
Yes,
within the defense. That's not too surprising given the state of Nebraska secondary and the fact that the coaching staff went after some JUCO recruits to try to find some immediate help back there. But I guess, what is your initial reaction to that? And do you have any other predictions in terms of other units that might need help from the incoming class after watching spring?
I'm not surprised. I shouldn't say that I'm not surprised. I didn't think Chris Jones was a definitive answer at that cornerback spot anyway. So I'm unconvinced that he's going to be your day one top shelf starter. I think Joshua Kalu is rock solid. I don't know that I feel the same way about Chris Jones. This will open the door for Eric Lee, and you know he's going to have an opportunity. Certainly, the guys coming in like Lamar Jackson, Markel Dismuke, they're going to have great chances too. And even potentially Tony Butler, who obviously is slated as a safety but knows how to play corner. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation to have, and we'll just see. You know, it's I don't know. I mean.
Is the Caprio Boodle kind of just...
I'd be surprised.
Time to add some weight and learn a position a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Jones will be healthy back by then. Bose Joseph's in the program. I think you need 4 or 5 corners. I think ideally you'd love to have Lamar Jackson, you know, come in and be a star right away. But Lamar is going to be a boundary guy, which means he would be, you know...
Backing up Kalu, right?
Yeah,
is that right?
Backing up Kalu.
I can't remember how they're lining up right now.
No, that's how they would do it. And so, you know, we'll see kind of where they move everybody. The advantage that Nebraska has is that Kalu is versatile enough to play at a lot of different positions. Technically, your best corner, you want to have him at boundary. But if you had to move him over to the field or in the slot, Kalu can do all of those things. He's a versatile football player. I'm not sold on the secondary anyway. As you know, I am not sold on the defense, period. I'm not convinced that it's going to be significantly better, if better at all, than it was last year. So, there's still things out there that I'm not sure of and questions that I still have about that defense. And I just don't think there's a lot that can be defined or settled right now. But Chris Jones being out is only going to give some other people an opportunity to get some more reps, which you know, when you get down to brass tacks, it's probably not a bad thing. Yeah. They probably need to get some more people, some more work.
So what's your thought on Chris Jones? Because I thought he played pretty good football at the end of the year, the second half of the season. He was showing signs, and I agree with you. He hasn't had a great spring. He's been beaten at times, and I don't think he's shown the same physicality that I saw from him at the end of the year either, just kind of getting in guys' faces at the line of scrimmage and using his strength to his advantage. But what have you seen in the limited, you know, opportunities that we've been able to watch practice from Chris Jones that kind of has you wondering a little bit if he can hold down that spot in the fall?
Well, he got burned for a touchdown in the Foster Farms game. A long one, no less. So
that was a fast dude.
Yeah, but I want to hesitate to presume that he was playing that good.
Okay.
I don't think he was playing that good. I think he was okay. I think he got beat for a long touchdown in the UCLA game. And anybody who gets beat, right?
Yeah.
So that's something that they've got to think about. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I thought he got beat in camp here too. Like, I just didn't think – that's not a knock on the kid. I just don't think he's a top-shelf – corner right now in the league. And
at this moment,
I wouldn't put him in the top half corners in the league. So I think anytime that you have a little bit of a deficiency there, then you have to think about, well, how are you going to Is this guy somebody you want to roll out there? Is this guy somebody you don't want to roll out there? I mean, I've got memories of the 2016, which I think is right around the time you arrived here in Nebraska. But that team had a lot of pieces, but the two things they didn't have were corners. Their corners were Andre Jones and I think Courtney Grigsby, and those guys weren't good enough.
Yeah.
They got beat, and it probably cost Nebraska one or two games because they just didn't have good enough corners. So I think there's a reason why they want to put Lamar Jackson and Markell at corners, because they want to have big guys out there that can get physical and make plays. And I still think that secondary is a couple years away, maybe one, maybe two, away from being exactly what they want it to be, just because, I don't know that all the pieces are in place. So, you know, it's not a knock on Chris Jones. I just, when you got two top of the half league corners, then you're in good shape. And I don't think Nebraska has that right.
Well, especially with the type of defense that Nebraska's going to run.
Here's the thing, John. Let's say we were sitting here last year, you and me sitting here, we're talking about corners. What's the first thing we would have said about cornerbacks? What's the first thing we would have said? Who's the first name we would have brought up?
Oh, Davey?
Yeah. Daniel Davey will be one of their corners. Well, no, he wouldn't. He wasn't very good.
Yeah.
Got beat a lot. There's a deeper challenge to playing corner in this system when you don't have any help over the top. Right. You know, you're having to carry people all the way down the field. Safety's got to carry people too. And so the coverage responsibilities have changed. Nebraska corners used to know that there was going to be a safety over the top on post routes, on deep routes, on things like that. Now, it's way different, right? It's just a way different system. And so they have a harder time, you know, just slicing and dicing people. I mean, it's not going to be the way that it used to be under Bo Pelini. You need corners that can turn and run and cover and have the confidence to continually do that deep. Because the way that you beat this defense, Mark Banker's defense, is to throw over the top. To attack them and throw it over the top and then throw it in between the safeties and the linebackers if the linebackers don't get good drops. And so when we saw teams attack Nebraska's defense, what did we see? The quick slants, because linebackers weren't dropping very well. We saw the deep balls going over the top. We saw play action pass with tight ends going over the middle and getting lost from the safeties because the safeties got confused in coverage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I just don't think the secondary is there. This was one of the worst pass defenses in college football last year. That didn't change in the offseason. It just didn't. Now, part of it's the pass rush. Part of it's the guys just aren't very good covering. Part of it was the scheme and the incongruency between the scheme and whatever. But they gave up 300-some passing yards in the bowl game, too. So, like, it's not a finished product. It's just not.
Any other positions that you have seen in the spring that'll need one of these young freshmen that are entering, joining the team in summer camp? Need him to play, need him to contribute.
I'm sure they're going to give, they're going to test drive the car on Colin Miller and Quayshon Alexander and maybe even Pernell Jefferson in terms of pass rusher. But
yeah,
you don't know until those guys actually get here whether they're going to be, you know, full Hulk steel, ready to roll as a collegiate pass rusher. You just don't know it until they actually show up. So it's hard because you'd like to project. Like I put something out there about DeMorney Pearsonell. He's got to return punts unless he's like 50%. They got to bring him back. He's got to play.
There's no question about that. If he's healthy, you have to have
him.
Well,
I mean, healthy. Like, let's put healthy around quotes. He doesn't have to be 101% to play.
Well, if he feels healthy, then
right. Yeah, if he can play, yeah, he should play.
Oh yeah.
Simple. Let's not get caught up in the whole, you know, well, we want to protect his redshirt season. And you know, that gets back into the Jamal Turner territory where everybody was worried about whether Jamal was going to have enough touches and going to get enough time in the offense and end up hurting Jamal. Like, I think he struggled with the impression over many, many years that he should have been more involved than he was instead of just earning the plays. DeMorney just needs to do what he does really well and earn his time in the offense. But the point is that I got a bunch of stuff on Twitter like, well, J.D. Spielman can handle it. Nobody knows that. We don't know that. We don't know that. We can presume it because he was good in high school and he played for the best school in the state of Minnesota. And we can presume that he might be able to handle it, but we don't actually know that Spielman can handle that. Maybe he can and maybe he can't. You know, he's a good player, and I was as high on him as anybody. But we don't know it until he actually shows up, right?
DeMorne Pearsonell,
we just don't know.
I know. But we know what we know is that DeMorne Pearsonell was a freshman, was the best punt returner in college football.
He was an Alabama level punt returner.
He had more yards actually, coincidentally, than any punt returner since I think Javier Arenas in like 08 or 09.
Alabama level.
Right. So he returned punts at the highest level possible in college football. He won Nebraska a game against Iowa by getting him back. He almost brought Nebraska back against Michigan State. Sorry. And he deserves an assist for the Purdue game when he returned a couple punts and gave Nebraska's offense incredible starting field position when it couldn't do anything right that day and gave him a nice cushion to start the game. So to take that type of player off the field for a full season, and we're talking about a team that has as many question marks as it does on defense and whether or not a quarterback, you know, they're going to find some consistency there. Can they run the ball like they want to? I mean, there's so many questions for Nebraska, and Nebraska doesn't have this overabundance of talent when you compare it to the rest of the teams on its schedule to where it can just walk on the field and beat someone up physically and win the game. Why would you take away that weapon?
They're not going to. Yeah. The point is, and I'd heard this sort of scuttlebutt around. I got a couple emails about it. You think he should redshirt? I'm like, no. I don't know, but like, and then people say, "Well, what if he's not healthy?" Well, okay, you know what? I'm not a doctor, and neither is anyone else. So I guess we'll find out in 4 months.
I guess that's the question.
I would assume that he's going to come back because guess what? That's a safe assumption based on the fact that he'd have 10 months to rehab it.
Yeah,
you know, and I've seen other guys that had his injury, like Sean Fisher, play the next season. You can't just say, well, put this guy on the shelf because we've got some other punt returner that can handle it, and we want to make sure that he has 2 full years of being one of the best receivers on the team. No. You can't take an Alabama level punt returner off the roster for a year so that he can get more catches in a couple more years. That's absurd. Like, you can't worry about whether he's the 5th or 6th best receiver on the roster right now.
And DeMorne,
who cares? I mean, he's the best punt returner.
He's not going to want to sit
down. No. So
that's not his personality.
The gist of my point all along was the assumption that these guys are just going to come in and handle it. We don't know that. We actually don't know. They got to come in. They got to actually handle college life. They have to actually acclimate to the system. And although we can make guesstimates, we don't actually know until they show up. No one would have said that Antonio Reed was one of the top guys in the program last year. No one would have said that. He was a 2-star recruit. He was the last guy they got. He was totally under radar. Nobody thought he was going to play right away as a true freshman. Then we saw him show up on fan day and we're like, whoa, this guy is a stud. And then we watched him at practice and we're like, whoa, this guy's going to play. Like, but you don't know that until they come. You just can't predict that stuff.
Well, another guy that's kind of had his share of whoa moments in spring is Darion Grimm. I think he's going to find a way onto the field in the fall.
Yes.
He's shown that. Nebraska recruiting-wise, I don't remember. Did we talk about Keyshawn Johnson Jr.'s commit a couple weeks ago? I don't remember if we did on
the
podcast.
We certainly can if you want to.
Well, you got him. But
we can talk about Jebbia now.
And Tristan Jebbia. It's like Jebbia. I guess for Nebraska, is it the Huskers in about as good a spot as they could have hoped for at this point in 2017? I mean, it seems like they got a lot of momentum, a lot of eyes on them nationally. Yep. Two high-profile additions that are really active on social media, and you can tell they're sort of interwoven into the football culture in L.A. Yep. That the impact of what they say and what they do is noticed by top-tier recruits in California, especially in the L.A. area. So Nebraska's earning some credibility. It's kind of gaining in popularity, which I feel like is a huge deal in recruiting nowadays, especially in the social media era. You've got once kids kind of, you know, it, I mean, it's like anything on the internet. You know, once it starts snowballing in a certain direction, positive or negative, it's really hard to stop that snowball. And right now, everything's snowballing positively for Nebraska, and I feel like more and more recruits are sort of latching on to that idea that, oh, okay, Nebraska is a little bit more than just cornfields and a program that used to be good.
Right. Tristan Jebbia, it's really good to have a quarterback in your system 10 months before signing day. And here's why. Because now that guy is like the quarterback in the class. And so he's going to text guys and call guys and say, hey, you know, I'm in the class. I want you to join the class. Well, let's say that they don't know who he is. Like, it's some kid from Alabama or Florida. Oh, okay, who are you? So they check him out on Twitter. Okay. And then they look him up on 247 or Rivals or Scout or ESPN. They're like, oh, this guy's a four-star. He's a top 100. And he's from Calabasas. Oh, look at his teammate. That's Keyshawn's quarterback. And then all of a sudden it's like, all right, well, maybe I'll take a look. And I'm not even talking about the California guys. The California guys already know all this stuff because they're connected to Keyshawn Sr. and Keyshawn Jr. and Jebby. I'm talking about all the other guys all over the country, right? Remember that Keyshawn Johnson Jr. and Tristan Jebby are now going to reach out to kids that they don't even know and say, hey, we're in the program, we're in the class, we want you to join it, come join us. And they'll all know who Keyshawn Johnson Jr. is, but they'll not know who the quarterback is. And once they do know, they're going to look at him and say, he's a top 100 guy. Okay. And they're going to go and look at his huddle highlights. This is how these kids think.
Right.
Whoa, this guy can throw. Maybe I want to go there. Maybe I want to protect for that guy. Maybe I want to be this guy's offensive tackle. Maybe I want to go to tight ends. The thing I would do with Jebbia is I tell Jebbia to reach out to tight ends and say, here's a guy that can throw the ball to you in the seam. Guy's got a rocket arm. He's going to get the ball to you. He's not going to overthrow you because he's got a big arm. He doesn't have to float the ball. Come play for us. Here we are. Let's roll. So that's what I would do. I think that his momentum will help them. They still got to find defensive pass rushers and
tackles
offensive tackles. So in the hierarchy of importance, right? Like, quarterback's number one. In my opinion, number two is pass rusher, so defensive end. And then it's corner. And then it's wideout. And then it's offensive tackle. Like, those, that would be the hierarchy of importance for me if I were building a team. In the NFL or in college, those are the positions I would look at. And so you got to say Nebraska's in decent shape at quarterback. They're in pretty good shape, better than decent at wide receiver. They're getting there with the corners. I think they need another year worth of good corners. And now they need pass rushers and offensive tackles because they don't have those. Like, they really, really need an elite pass rusher. And you know what? I like the big 330-pound nose plug tackles too. You really need somebody who can rush off the end. You need an elite guy that's got speed and size. And they must go find one. John Perella has to. And the challenge that Perella's got is that he may not be able to find. You might find that kid in the Midwest about one out of every 3 or 4 years. And guess what? The one guy that is going to Iowa because his dad went to Iowa, A.J. Espenza. And he's a five-star. He's gone. He's off the board. He's going to Iowa. So he's done. So the one guy in the Midwest every year that's elite in that level, they can't get. So now you got to go wherever you got to go to find him.
And wherever you go, he's going to be courted by all the other big-time schools in his backyard because everyone wants pass rushers.
Generally, unless you can find somebody that, like,
is under the radar,
emerges late.
Yeah.
And, like, is kind of under the radar, but maybe just started playing football or et cetera, and you look at him and you're like, okay, this dude's a freak. And Alex Davis may end up there. Mm-hmm. I think there's a chance of that. But
he really looks the part, man.
Alex Davis looks
like a stud in the making. But obviously
he's kind of a tall drink of water. I don't. It depends on what you're looking for from pass rushers. If you were to ask me, Sam, what is your ideal pass rusher? I would say Von Miller is to me the guy that I would want.
What's
rushing,
Von Miller? What is
pass.
He like 6'3" or something?
6'2", 251.
Yeah.
So Von Miller, both, but I'm not just talking Von Miller in the pros, though he was a Super Bowl MVP. Von Miller in college was elite. He was an incredible pass rusher for not being a huge guy. So if you were asking me, who would you want to be your pass rusher? Well, I'd like a guy that's, 6'3", 255, 260. Grant Wistrom. Grant wasn't, 280 pounds. At least I don't think he was. He was probably 265. So you want guys that are elite level NFL caliber pass rushers. And, those are the people you want in your program. And I think they got to find those. And then John Perella's going to have to find them. The advantage you got with Perella is he knows what they look like because he played with them.
Yeah. 6'3", 250, according to NFL.com.
I don't think he's 6'3". I think that's inaccurate. But anyway.
I see what you're pointing. So you're not.
John Perella knows what great
pass
rushers look like because he played in the NFL for 13 years. And if you're and it is his responsibility to go find them.
The one thing about a lean 6'6 guy who's got some burst, which I think Alex Davis does, and he's just got to obviously learn a lot of things.
Right.
But in the college game, I think you can get away with that because the tackles aren't as good. So, like, sure. Even if they know, oh, this guy's coming off the edge, sure. And he's going to do this, this, and this, like, oh, he's only got a couple moves in his arsenal, sometimes it's just hard for them to stop anyway because they're just not very good. Now, I agree with you, though, that the one thing about what Vaughn has is, man, he's got so much strength. And he's got that quickness. It doesn't matter that he's, doesn't have the wingspan of, like,
giant.
But
most people would say the best defensive player in the NFL is J.J. Watt. And I agree that he is. I'm just saying that getting that player is hard to – it's hard to figure because it's kind of like getting Rob Gronkowski on your roster. Like, you just don't know how you're going to finagle it. Or Calvin Johnson. Like, yeah, these guys kind of grow into it, and it's kind of like the gem moment. What you ideally would want are guys like Von Miller and Justin Houston, and just classic speed pass rushers. And, again, John Perrella's got to find him. Gotcha. And I don't think that guy's in the Midwest this year with the exception of the guy that's already committed to Iowa. So he's going to have to go find the elite guys somewhere else. And then I want him to get some corn-fed dudes. I want some Midwestern kids in the program. You know, I think you need some of that elbow grease and that, hey, I'm going to be a good player when I'm a sophomore, because I need a couple years to eat some food and build some weight. But then I also think you need some guys, and Nebraska has long had these, John, for as long as I can recall. When Nebraska was really, really good in the 80s and 90s, they had guys that could fly off the edge like nobody's business. Neil Smith, Broderick Thomas, Kenny, oh, goodness gracious, I can't remember Kenny's last name, but, Mike Kroll, they've always had him. So, yeah, got to go find him.
Yeah, the one thing about Midwest,
Kenny Walker,
isn't it? There's always sort of a stereotypical sort of summation of Midwestern guys that they'll just kind of grind it out. They'll be a little bit nasty. They'll work a little bit harder.
I think that's a fair stereotype, and I think it's a true one.
Yeah. Well, I think the interesting part about the two guys that just secured commits from and Tristan Jebbia and Keyshawn Johnson Jr. is they have a little bit of that in them. I mean, the thing with Keyshawn Jr. that I'm not around him 24/7. I've talked to him. I've talked to his dad, but it does seem like he's pretty driven. And the same with Tristan, in that they have a close connection to someone who's done it at a high level. And he's worked with a ton of quarterback gurus, and the coach at Calabasas is Casey Clawson. He got a chance to work with Jimmy Clawson at times when Jimmy came back. They've had connections with guys, and obviously Keyshawn is with his dad. They have connections with guys who have done it at the high level, and so they've seen firsthand sort of what it takes, and they're driven to make that, to take the same route.
Sure.
And
well, you'd hope that would continue.
But it's not always
true.
It's not always the case. A lot of times you hear California kids are they're just gonna kind of coast and be happy to be there, it can be applied to any number of where you're from or. What caliber of player you are, how highly rated you are, but you don't hear that a lot from Midwestern guys. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean we'll see how that
fair or not, but
how that pans out with those two guys.
Connie Yori,
okay,
resigned.
Yeah, she did
on Tuesday, and from the outside, Sam, it's hard for me to fully get a clear picture of what is going on, and that's I think we're still trying to. Parse out all the information and distribute it to our readers as best we can. But Connie Yori resigned. Would she have resigned if this investigation weren't going on?
I don't think so. I mean, let's start with this. Ultimately, there's a lot of variables here that I think a lot of people are going to get hurt. I think Connie's hurt. I think her ex-players, whom I heard from way too many of them yesterday, a lot of them are hurt.
Yeah.
Like, they don't understand what's going on. They're confused. They're frustrated. They didn't see the way that Connie was acting as a problem. I think some of the current players are hurt, even some of the ones that had a problem with Connie Yori. I don't know that they – so I think there's a lot of things at play here. There's coaches who are hurt. I think there's former coaches who were in the program who are hurt. I think this whole thing – has the tinge of real sadness to it. Like, this isn't how anybody wanted this stuff to end.
Yeah.
Connie Yori, you covered her, and I did too.
For about 4 years, I think.
Connie is the kind of person who could say things that would go over like a lead balloon. You know that. I mean, you covered it too.
Yeah, she was like...
she would say things, you're like, oh, man. Okay, that wasn't the best way to say that.
Well, she was just sort of like, I don't know how exactly to describe her. I mean, she was just tough.
Yeah.
She was a grinder,
could be very self-deprecating.
Yeah, and she would drain a lot out of you. Like, she wanted to drain the most out of you, because I think that's how she played, and that's how she lived her life.
She was splayed out on a court, passed out, because she wouldn't take a game off.
Right.
Like, that's one of the defining images, is she's completely splayed out because she collapsed in exhaustion.
And that's...
She exhausted herself. That image is everything, right?
That's exactly how, like, I covered that team that won all its regular season games in 2009-10. And at the end of the year, those players were in that same vein. They were exhausted. They put everything into it. And I think that's what Kanayori demands. And so... Some players respond to that, and some don't.
Yeah, and, you know, like, I guess the general vibe that I'm getting to here is that I'm not – I think that as hard as this is, it's just unfortunate it ended this way, because I think the outcome that they're going to go and get another coach and that Connie's not going to be the coach anymore is not the worst outcome. The program was starting to operate to diminishing returns, and – as it turns out, I don't know that it was going to get a lot better. Like, I'm not confident that next season, even though they had they have a decent recruiting class coming in, I'm not confident it was going to get better next year. I didn't see that team being a 25 or 26 win team. I remember telling Thad, our boss, before the season, this team's, if they're lucky, they're going to be lucky to get to the NCAA tournament. I don't think they're going to get there. So, like, this program, it really is actually in need of someone else being the coach.
Just new life.
But not because of the way that this thing has turned out. Like, in a perfect world, you would love to see people have an awareness of, you know what, I've been a coach for 25 years, I've been here for 14 years, and I've taken it as far, and, you know, for her to say, I've taken it as far as I can take it. I would have loved to have seen... if it was potentially true, and I don't know that she believes it, but I believe it. She'd taken it as far as she was going to take it. You can't take this thing all the way to the Final Four on elbow grease and sarcasm, and you can't. You need better players than she had. I think one of the reasons that the players were worked so hard and they grinded so much, it's because they just didn't have enough good basketball players. They didn't have enough depth. They didn't have enough talent. They weren't able to knock teams out of the box. I used to see this a lot where they'd be up 13 or 14 points, and she just didn't feel comfortable bringing her best players out of the game. You know, I remember Jordan Hooper playing 37 minutes in games where they won by 14. And you're like, why is Jordan out there for so long? And Jordan could handle it. Jordan's a tough cookie for as sweet of a human being as she was. But you're like, why? Get these players out of there. Like, get them out. And there was just something about Connie, other than the season that you covered, where they played 12 or 13 players in every game.
They were like 8 to 10.
Yeah, but they blew some more teams out. So at the end of the games, you saw people that really were really deep reserves playing. Like, Kelsey Griffin didn't have to play 39 minutes. There was one year where Rachel Terrio, this is her sophomore year, I have to go back and look at it. I think Rachel averaged 39.7 minutes, some insane number.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she never came off the court. That's there's no reason when you're winning 26 games, why would that be true? It just shouldn't be true. So I think Connie had, you know, the roster was a little too small. It wasn't talented enough. The players, you know, some of the players were getting ridden for 38 minutes a game. You know, you could just tell. It's like, gosh darn, you gotta push this thing all the way to the floor just to squeeze out 23 wins. And at some point you say, well, is the juice here worth the squeeze? And none of this has anything to do with the allegations, which we can talk about in a second. But the program, I think, had just hit a point where it was going to be good to get a fresh pair of eyes in there. You know, she had alienated enough coaches in the area where she wasn't going to get some of the best recruits from this region. She had alienated enough, and it's okay. It's life, right? Somebody's in a job for 14 years. This is life. This is what happens. There is no such thing as a marriage except a marriage. Like, there's no such thing as a business marriage. That's not true. So, you know, the program kind of peaked a couple of years ago. The last 2 years have been really exhausting, even for me. And I didn't think she handled things very well at times this year. So ultimately, I think they're getting to the right place, which is getting a new coach.
Right. It's just a tragic sort of way to
right.
roundabout way to end to that conclusion. Right. Okay.
And then you look at the social aspect of it, John. And the social aspect of it is this. And I'm going to try to be right down the middle of the road because I'm still kind of reporting the story. But can you envision a world in which something that would be gray to you isn't gray to other people? Like something where you'd say, yeah, you know, that's just kind of how they are. And yet to somebody else, it's like, I don't care if that's how they are. That's not right. They see the difference?
Yeah,
there?
Yeah.
I think ultimately what had happened, especially this season, but even a little bit in the last two seasons, is I think you just had people where they're like, you know what? Yeah, that's how you are, but I'm just kind of sick and tired of that. And it's got to change. And I think there was a fatigue that set in. Obviously, her divorce issue was a major issue this year. And you could tell the strain that was on her, and I don't think it was good. But there just kind of comes a point, and usually it comes 10, 12, 15 years into a person's career, where all of a sudden not everybody's willing to do everything they want them to do anymore.
Yeah, but is that even fair? Is that, I mean, this may not be a question you can answer, but is it fair for people who are, you know, a part of the program, whether it's administration or players or assistant coaches, to make that judgment to say, you know what, I don't think that what Coach Yori, how she carries herself in practice or how she handles interactions with players or how
things she might have asked people to do.
Yeah, like, I don't think that that's right. Is that fair for them to make that judgment?
It can be. It depends on what it is. Right? It depends on what it is. But here's what I also know, is that there were investigations done at Illinois and Wichita State that were more thorough than the ones that were done at Nebraska. And by thorough, I mean they were longer, and both of those coaches kept their jobs.
Yeah, but do we even know what the investigation, what the result of the investigation was? Like, has Nebraska released any information?
They're not going to release anything. What we know is that there were players who were approached and players who approached.
Do you know if Nebraska ever discussed it with Coach Yori, the investigation?
Like, absolutely.
Okay.
She knew.
Well, she knew what was going on. Did they ever discuss the results of it, or?
I don't think it was necessarily over. I think there was just a sense of, I think the thing was just sort of hanging out there. And I'm sure.
Well, because it looks like, I mean, from the outside, like Nebraska was sort of building a case.
And she decided to hit the eject button.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean.
She said, hey, you know what? Let's just figure out a financial agreement and let's just go from there.
That's
possible, John. I think there's a distinct possibility that that's what happened. I think that there's more to learn in this situation. It's just sometimes in life, things, you know, the perception of a person changes. And the paradox of a college coach is this, and we saw this even with Bo, okay?
Yeah.
You and I didn't necessarily see this. Dirk Chatelain didn't see this, but a lot of people did. There's a lot of reporters that didn't step to Bo until after he was fired. There's a lot of people who towed that company line. Dirk didn't, to his credit. I think I asked hard questions at times that he didn't like. I think you did too. There's a lot of people that just kind of let it all scoot along until he was out. And then after he was out, it turned into, well, we knew all that, and yeah, it was a bad fit. But it didn't happen until he was fired. And I think for a lot of people, you know, that's the nature of college coaching. The person is the ultimate authority until they're fired, and then they didn't know a dang thing.
Right.
That's a lot of times how it is. Like, they knew everything until the minute they knew nothing at all. And that's part of the challenge of college coaching. It's not true in the pros. There are players who make three times what the coaches do, and they will tell you how they think, and they will tell you off the record, and sometimes they'll say on the record. And guess what? What Kevin Durant thinks of the Oklahoma City Thunder is a hell of a lot more important than what Billy Donovan thinks, because Kevin Durant is Oklahoma City Thunder. It isn't Billy Donovan, and it wasn't his predecessor. Ditto with the Golden State Warriors. What Steph Curry thinks is a lot more important than Steve Kerr, and how do we know? Because Steve Kerr didn't even coach the team for half the year, and they won 40 games without him. With Luke Walton, it doesn't matter who the coach is. It matters what Steph Curry and Draymond Green and, you know, what Klay Thompson think. That's what matters. But in college, that balance is so out of whack that the coach becomes the ultimate authority, and the player can often not say or act in a way that shows, guess what, buddy? We both know that the key to this team ain't you, it's me. You don't see that in college. And so inevitably, these kinds of things happen. Whereas in the pros, guess what? If a coach is a hard you-know-what, is a tough person, and the best player on the team don't like it, the best player is going to have a say.
Yeah.
They're going to go to the owner and say, I'm the one paying the bills here, not the coach. But in college coaching, players have a very hard time. And coaches, and I feel for coaches too, because coaches have a very hard time being able to say, you're right, I screwed up. You're right, I made a mistake. They have a hard time because nobody's going to ever tell them they did.
Yeah, but even if you do, you kind of back yourself into a corner, because then that gives, you know, your detractors, whether it's people in the administration or boosters or fans or media, it gives them sort of a window, you know, like a sniper looking for a window to shoot someone. Like, they give them a target to fire, you know,
But do I think that Connie might have had an opportunity over the years to say, because we'd ask her about injuries and we'd ask her about player and say, you know what, we need to reexamine that. And and furthermore, and this is what I think is really true, we need to have a deeper and more talented roster than we do. Because I'm telling you what, outside of that Jordan Hooper team and the Lindsay Moore team, the two teams that kind of went back to back with Sweet 16 second round, she had some teams that were just crawling over the finish line to get to an NCAA tournament. And you know what? First round of the NCAA tournament is not the be-all, end-all. You have to figure out a way. It kind of be like, I don't know how to explain it. You know, it kind of be like, running, like in 2011, when Nebraska got toward the end of the season and they just ran, remember how they just ran the hell out of Rex Burkhead?
Yeah.
I mean, they ran the hell out of him.
38 carries or something.
And it's like, God dang, they ran the hell out of Rex. And it's like, is it really worth all this just to go 9-4 and to work a guy into the ground, and then next year he gets hurt with a knee injury, and it spoils what could have been a really great season because he got hurt and he was out for a long time. Is it worth all that? You know, is it really worth running Amir Abdullah at second and goal at the half yard line because you're afraid you're not going to score if you put anybody else in because you're playing Purdue, and he gets hurt, and then he doesn't play. You know, he can't perform in the big game against Wisconsin the way you want. Like, is it worth all that? And so, like, when I was thinking about that Rex situation where they just worked the hell out of Rex that one year, and I'm like, is it worth all this? Like, you got to find a better way.
Yeah.
And I think whoever the next coach is, and we can move on, has got to find a better way. Because I think for Connie, it was just tough. And there's a lot of things I liked about her. She could be very, the banter was always interesting with her.
I always appreciated her. She was smart.
She was sharp-tongued.
And yeah,
she really gave as good as she got.
Got some quick wit.
But you could also see how we could handle that, and people who are 10 years or 15 years younger than us
may not.
If they stepped to her in a situation in a practice or something, and she shot something back because she was quick-witted and she was could be acid-tongued, that it would have a chilling effect.
Yeah.
That it would be like, well, I'm never doing that again because I know what happens when I try to speak my mind. So
yeah, I think she's a good coach, and you know, if she wants to keep coaching, I'm sure she'll have an opportunity to do so at some point.
Thanks for letting me expound on that.
Yeah, no, that's good. It was good stuff. I want to ask you real quick. We'll talk some. You want to talk some Nebraska baseball? What I mean, you're sort of an outsider. What's your view of what halfway through the season right now? Nebraska's 19-9, just lost to K-State on Tuesday.
I didn't even know what happened last night, but they lost, though.
Yeah, they lost. They were 2-for-12 with runners in scoring position, had 5 Ks in those situations, just didn't get a big hit. And they weren't that's the theme of the season so far. It's interesting because Darren Erstad's teams have played really good defense under him. They did lose a really good defensive catcher, a good defensive third baseman, and a great defensive outfielder in Austin Darby. So they lost some pieces there. So you expected a little bit of a dip, but this under Erstad, Nebraska's been pretty consistently sound fundamentally in terms of fielding the baseball. This year it hasn't been, and there was just a couple instances on Tuesday where you're like,
Schlepenbaugh dropped that ball.
That was Sunday, Friday? I think.
Okay.
To Saturday. But, you know, yeah, in every game, there have been moments where you're like, well, you know, a team 2 years ago wasn't making that mistake. And now Nebraska's been able to cover it up a lot because it's hit the ball so well.
Yeah.
But, you know, those tiny mistakes, you know, giving up a home run. Jake Meyers pitched for the first time in a month, and he pitched really well. He just had one mistake home run, you know, and a double play that should have been turned led to a run, and then a walk leads to a run in the seventh inning. So those little tiny mishaps resulted in a loss to a team that Nebraska should have beat.
My outside perception is that, you know, the number of base on balls walks is concerning.
Yeah.
You know, can you hope?
It's
probably
the key to the season going forward.
Relying on that much offense is tricky. So they've got two big series at Michigan and Michigan State.
Yep.
You know, if they go 1-5 in those series or 2-4, you know, what's it going to look like? I don't know. Are they in a line for an NCAA, non-conference title bid right now?
At-large bid, is that what you're thinking? I think their RPI is just inside the top 50, so we'll see what happens once they play teams like Michigan and Michigan State who have pretty high winning percentages. A couple more games with Creighton, like you would think that'll boost them up just by playing those games. And the fact that they're on the road, if they can win a couple. You know, RPI in RPI lingo, if you go to Michigan and you lose 2 of 3, it's basically even because you get 1.3 win points for a win, and then on a loss on the road, it's 0.7. So you add up two losses, it's 1.4, which is one, and it's equal to 1.3 wins. So it's you basically split if you go on the road and you win 1 of 3 from in RPI terminology.
Right.
So I think Nebraska, if it's within the top 3-4 of the Big Ten and doesn't, you know, get swept at Michigan State or at Michigan, we'll have a good shot at an at-large bid. But I think the walk issue is certainly concerning. And the problem is it's kind of it's plaguing guys who have previously not been victimized by that. You know, like a reliever like Jeff Chestnut walked, I think it was like 9 batters in 43 innings, and he's already surpassed his walk total this year. Nine batters in 43 innings last year. You know, it wasn't an issue control. Derek Burkamper was another guy. I think he walked like 17
batters.
Maybe
they don't trust the defense.
In 63 innings last year. And, yeah, maybe that's part of it. Now Burkamper might have something wrong with his back. Colton Howell's kind of been had issues all year.
That's
you know?
Bad for Burkamper.
So, yeah, they got to get it right. They got to figure out a way to you know, they've relied on some young freshmen. What's funny is the younger guys have done a better job attacking the strike zone with confidence and fearlessness than the older guys. So it's a little bit of a puzzling situation that we've seen from the pitching staff so far.
I'm sure Erstedt's not happy with the way the pitching staff is hot and cold, but, you know, what's the magic number? You know, 38, 39?
Something like that, and they're at 19 halfway through the season, so they're on pace. They're on pace.
I think that's what's important is making the regional. And, you know, John, I don't know that they're ever going to build a – top 10 team. I really don't know. I mean, it's several years into the Erstedt era, so sooner or later you'd like to see them have the kind of team that comes out of the gate and is 30-4 and, you know, erases all doubt.
Well,
I don't really think that's the trending marker of their program.
The thing is like Nebraska they've got regional quality talent. This team has it's a disappointment if it doesn't make a regional.
Sure.
But it's not LSU. It's not A&M. It's not Florida. I mean, those guys – Florida had something – I went through the roster. They had something like 18 players that have been drafted at one point or another. I'm just like, this team is loaded. So, you know, there's some work that needs to be done in terms of recruiting the higher regarded talented players. And Nebraska thought it had an in with the Jackson Reitz. It thought it had a chance with a Monte Harrison. You know, like, those are the guys you have to have if you want to consistently be a top 10, top 15 team. Because, you know, a TCU's getting a catcher, a freshman catcher who's like a first-round draft pick, you know, to say, no, I'm not going to play college ball. Or I'm not going to play pro ball. I'm going to play college. You know, that kind of thing.
That would help.
You got any MLB predictions?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
What's your World Series matchup?
Oh, well, we're going to start with the big ones.
Okay, well, do you want to go division by division?
We'll go to the divisions in a second. My World Series right now would probably be Jays, Nats.
I have Astros, Nats.
Okay.
Why do we like the Nats? Because new management?
I think Dusty Baker is probably going to be a good manager for that franchise. because I think he'll be able to manage some of the egos a little bit better. I think Matt Williams kind of screwed the team up last year. They have good pitching, and they have the best. They have the second best player in baseball.
Yeah, Bryce Harper. So,
that helps, right? You know, having the second best player in baseball. It'd be even better if they had the first, but you know, for the they have enough pieces. I mean, certainly most people thought that they would be in a World Series by now. So, I'm confident that that the Nats will be there and that this will be their year. Sorry, Cubs. There's nothing against the Cubs. I mean, I think the Cubs got a 5-6 year window. So I'm pretty confident the Cubs will make a couple of World Series, and might even win one. I mean they're really well set up. But and then on the AL side, I actually thought the Jays were the best team last year. Royals just beat them, and you know I don't see Kansas City winning 95 or 96 games again. I just so many things last year fell into place so perfectly for KC to get that home field advantage. And if you put KC in that home field, you give them a couple of home games early. I mean, they are very, very tough to beat in that setting. It's a great crowd. It's a huge stadium. They feel very comfortable playing there.
It just feels like Kansas City, more than any team in the league, when things are rolling in its favor, like it's just such a confident team. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to break them of their that demeanor of, hey, we're going to find a way to win. And I don't know, it's just kind of ingrained. They're really good at manufacturing runs, and even when the pressure's on.
They're going to get stepped to by the White Sox this year, though. I think the White Sox are going to take them down the stretch. And I think the Royals are very competitive.
Wild card worthy then? Or
I think they're going to win the division.
Oh, okay.
But I think the White Sox are going to make them sweat.
Okay.
Make them use some more of their, you know. I think last year the Royals were so beautifully prepared for the postseason because they had nothing to – they had nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
I mean, they played so – they were able to get people healthy and be ready for the postseason in a way that they never would have been ready for in previous years because they were so far ahead. So, I think the Royals have a good chance of making the World Series, but I'll take the Jays. And then, I'll take the Nats. You like the Strohs.
I like the Strohs, man, the young talent.
Two pitchers, yeah, that helps.
A couple pitchers that are throwing the ball pretty well. I mean, their whole staff's not too bad.
They got a junk division, I know that.
Yeah.
So, well, Texas isn't junk, but they have a junk division. So they have a chance to win. You know, I always go with the win numbers, 92, 93, 94 games. If they win that many, they might just be able to have home field advantage. I think Toronto's somewhere around 90 to 92.
I'm not sold on the East either, honestly. I think the Central's the best division in the AL.
I think the Royals are probably around 89 to 91. I mean, I think it's all going to be tight. But the Royals, if I'm not mistaken, they won 95 games last year, right? That's 95 regular season, maybe 96. And that to me just seems high. Like, I think they're a 90-win ball club. I don't think there's going to be any 100-win ball clubs this year, but if there is going to be a 100-win ball club, I think it'll be the Jays.
I got the Pirates winning the Central over the Cubs.
Me too.
No knock on the Cubs, but I do think there's just going to be a little bit of a dip. You know, now the expectations are real and people are eyeballs on them. You know, they're, what are they, 5-1 favorites to win the World Series? Something crazy. I don't know what the odds are, but they were like the favorite to win the World Series going into the year. I just think that at some in a place like Chicago, Wrigley Field, man, it's such a pressure cooker, man. At some point, it's going to get to them, and they're going to start feeling it, and they're good enough to overcome it, but I think it will knock them down a couple notches, and in 2017, they'll make that run.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Cubs are well-positioned to be good for a long time. So I don't know what their pressure level is or if there's this high sense of expectation, but...
There's got to be.
It's not going to be easy. I mean, the NL is a pretty stuffed to the brim with good teams. I mean, the Giants are really good. The Dodgers, you know, are kind of poo-pooed. They still have the best pitcher in baseball. They still have some really good bats. I don't know.
All right, Sam. I'll let you go.
All right.
Your phone's buzzing, so that's a good thing. We'll be back shortly, maybe after the spring game, to talk a little Husker football and other cool things. See you later.